Welcome to Holyrood Ungagged, the Paul Grady of political podcasts. Season 5, Episode 3. I'm your host, Neil Anderson, broadcasting from an undisclosed location in the north of Glasgow. Joining me this evening is Peter McCall. He is a writer, a thinker, former director of Edinburgh University, and a serial green candidate. And once I've introduced our second guest, he's going to give us a fact for the day. And joining us in that, Jen Bell. She
Hiya.
is co-convener of the Scottish Green Party trade union group and also co-convener of the Rainbow Greens and is originally from Belfast.
It's true. Thank you so much for having me.
Right. Okay, Peter, what is your fact of the day?
The fact of the day isn't that we're both from Belfast, but that is a fact. You'll be hearing plenty of funny vowel sounds over the coming minutes and maybe hours. I discovered today that the world's largest parrot, which is called a kakapo, there are only 248 of them, and they all have their own names. So each one has its own name, which I think is a fantastic fact.
Who named them?
The New Zealand Conservancy Organisation. So they were thought to be, they thought that there were no more female kakapos left, and then they discovered 200 of them, and so they took them all into captivity, and they've got a captive breeding program.
And they just all hiding under the same rock or something.
Well, so the thing is, they're huge. They
Like
weigh
how
like
big are we talking? Like.
60 centimeters.
Wow, that's big.
The 2 feet. They're the world's
That's
biggest parrot.
so like the third of the size of you. Like about yay big.
You won't be able to see, but Jen is demonstrating just
Oh,
on 60 centimeters out.
I picked the perfect medium for this, like, because like I talk so much with my hands, and of course you're not gonna see my face, so
Yeah, two feet tall. So,
that is a hefty bird.
it's
That's
certainly is
a
that.
lot of bird.
Apparently, like many flightless birds, they were quite tasty, which is why they got themselves into trouble and close to extinction.
It seems to be a common problem with them, doesn't it? They're just too edible.
And too easy to capture, obviously.
Well, probably because they're so edible. I think there's an inverse proportion between like edibility and maneuverability.
Possibly.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but that's my off-the-cuff theory about
I
it.
should worry. I'm not very maneuverable, so I might be on the eat list.
Don't worry, I'm not going to eat you.
Right. Okay. Let's. We'll stop the. What is the word? I can't. Carnivorism, I suppose, is the word. And let's get ungagged. Right. Our first topic is about Scotland's new First Minister, Hamza Yousaf, and the choices that he has made for his new cabinet. The obvious one straight away is that another candidate for the leadership, Kate Forbes, was offered rural affairs but declined and has now left. And there's been complaints in various tabloid newspapers about a cabinet of cronies. But a thought on that for me is just, well, if you just become First Minister or if it was the UK Prime Minister, are you not going to put friends in your cabinet to begin with? But any thoughts on the actual people that have been put in place? We've got Shona Robinson as the Deputy First Minister. Michael Matheson as health, Jenny Gilruth on transport, Any
Yeah.
thoughts? Any
So
positions?
I think there's a really fascinating thing, which is whenever the more left-wing candidate wins these sorts of contests, there's always enormous pressure for them to put their right-wing opponent in their cabinet. That's always been the case. I don't really see that pressure when someone from the right wins. Someone from the right wins, they're picking people on merit, and it's great that they've got a fresh new cabinet. It's all good things. I think Hamza, he was running clearly to the left of Kate Forbes. Would it be possible to run to the right of Kate Forbes? Hard to tell. The enormous pressure that he's put under to have her in his cabinet. And I mean, I think at a very human level, the way in which Kate Forbes conducted the campaign, which was to feed a series of attack lines against Hamza, that were then picked up by the Conservative leader Douglas Ross, by the Labour leader Anas Sarwar, and used in First Minister's questions, didn't leave a great deal of space for Hamza to put her in his cabinet. She could have run a campaign
Hi.
that was about her own ideas and her own position, not about how incompetent she thought Hamza was. Well, let's leave aside the sort of racist undertones of Hamza being incompetent. But she could have run a campaign that was about her own ideas. Instead, she spent a lot of time attacking Hamza. And I think it's fairly reasonable for you to say you're running on a very different ideological platform to me. You've made this contest extremely personal. I don't see where the common ground is here for us to work together as colleagues. I can't have you in a senior role in cabinet because you don't agree with my direction, my political direction. My political direction is much closer to the manifesto, to what we were elected on, than what you're suggesting. So giving her a brief in rural affairs seemed not unreasonable. And given that she's making a lot out of her rural credentials, it seems somewhat petulant to turn that down, and then to claim that she'd done it because she didn't agree with the party's direction. Makes you wonder what she was doing around the cabinet table for all of this time. So I don't think it
That's
reflects
it.
particularly well on her, but I do think there's a commentariat class who were desperate to have her as leader because it would return Scottish politics to being something that looks like British politics, and that's what they've always been desperate for.
I mean, if I were Hamza Yousaf, I don't see why I'd want to work with Kate Forbes, considering that, throughout the campaign, while she was in the cabinet, she was trashing her own government's record and given her extreme views on trans rights, on LGBT rights, things that actually go against the Peel House Agreement. Her position would be untenable if she remained in the government and she held on to those views. And the way that I see it is Hamza Yousaf offering that role to her was quite generous, all considered.
Yep, indeed. You see there.
There's just one other thing, and I think Jane, you might want to come in on this as well. During the referendum in 2014, a lot of people told me that they were worried about Scottish politics becoming Ulsterised, becoming like the politics of Northern Ireland, about the constitution. Interestingly, a lot of those people were then not drawing parallels with the religious conservatives in Northern Ireland's government, in the Northern Ireland Assembly, when given the opportunity. They weren't complaining that here's somebody who doesn't believe that children should be born out of wedlock, or who wouldn't have voted for equal marriage. There was very little concern there. It's only when there's a concern about the continued existence of the British state that they're worried about Ulsterisation. And I think this really would have been a retrograde step. I mean, both Jen and I are originally from Belfast. She felt like a quite Northern Irish politician.
It really felt like a throwback to the DUP, a lot of the things that she was coming out with. It was surreal, to be honest. Watching those leadership hustings, it was like seeing the leaders of three different parties go at it. It's hard to believe that KFOR is in the same party as Hamza Yusuf, but there it is. Interesting on the idea of Ulsterization. I think it would be in the interests of I think both the centrist wing of the SNP and then the unionist parties to basically boil down all Scottish politics to constitutional issues. Because then every election is not really about policy. Just like back in Northern Ireland, it's not really about policy. It's just it's just a head count, basically, every time. And that makes an easy life for politicians, because then they don't actually have to govern the country.
And in Northern Ireland, of course, they choose not to.
Well, that's ridiculous. That is one of the many problems we have with media as it currently is, isn't it? They do boil it down to kind of single issues or one or two single issues, which people tend to focus on, and they don't paint the broad picture of what's going on.
More than one thing can be true at the same time. And these kind of situations can be nuanced and they can have multiple angles. But that doesn't sell papers, right? If you're trying to sell a paper, you want to get a simple, get one angle, one narrative, and just push that and just look at that to the exclusion of everything else. So of course you're going to say the First Minister is just packing his cabinet of cronies. That's simple. I mean, it's very lazy commentary, but it's simple, and it panders to a certain audience. Like it tells them what they want to hear about what's going on in Scottish politics. So they're going to push that.
So, are either of you, because I'm not particularly, to be honest, familiar with the other people that have been put in, or the people that have been put into the cabinet at the moment? So, Shona Robin Robinson as the deputy first minister.
It's Robinson. There's no N in
Robin,
it.
you're right. Yes, apologies.
I mean, Shona Robinson's one of those interesting characters. She's been there since 1999, and hasn't had an enormous profile. The Dundee MSP. She was health secretary for a while and ended up going over one of the many messes at NHS Tayside. I think she handled the gender recognition bill. She was the minister responsible for that. I thought she handled that very well. I mean, the stress on those supporting the bill as the Conservatives played silly games and taking Parliament into midnight sittings, which the Scottish Parliament, UK Parliament does do that. The Scottish Parliament doesn't do that. So it's not what people are used to, and having to be the cabinet secretary in charge for that full period, sitting for 6, 7, 8 hours, being on top of her brief on all of those amendments, and there were hundreds of amendments, was I thought a pretty impressive piece of work. And I mean, if you didn't watch the debate, I would recommend you don't watch it, because it was some of the worst political game playing I think I've ever seen. You had MSP standing up to make points of order and then turning their backs so that they couldn't be heard on the microphone, so that they'd have to make the point of order again. People asking what time the session was going to end repeatedly in order to extend the session. I mean, it was really bad behaviour. Even some of the Labour MSPs who didn't agree with the bill were getting very frustrated with the antics. And so for Shona to take that through, I thought was pretty impressive. And she was a strong advocate for Hamza through the process. And I think her promotion is on the basis of that. It'll be interesting to see what she makes of finance. And one of the interesting things about Scotland is that we don't have a treasury. We have a finance ministry that doesn't have the same powers as the treasury. So the treasury determines economic and often social policy at Westminster. The Scottish Finance Department doesn't really do that, so it's not as powerful a position. But she's got an opportunity to do something with more powers perhaps than some of her predecessors did.
Right,
Hi,
wow.
like hi, there's like yeah, I mean there's definitely like an opportunity with like, you know, this change of the cabinet and change of the government, because like, you know, there are some familiar faces, like some people are keeping their posts, like you know, like Jenny
Andrew
Gilruth,
Roberts.
for instance, right? But like all in all, it's like, you know, it's like a new cabinet, you know, you've got a new first minister who's like he's got his own priorities. And I think what's interesting about his position is that, you know, he's sort of got to like juggle these two faces, right? Or these two like facets of his, like, you know, as he's defining his style, his like form of leadership. Because like on the one hand, like during the leadership contest, like people were trying to tar him or like peg him as like Mr. Continuity. Like if you were voting for Hamza Yousaf, you were voting for the continuity candidate. And like, you know, he definitely played that up at points. Like he was you know, he's playing himself up as like the heir to Nicola Sturgeon's style of governance. But then you know, there's also like, you know, it's also like he recognizes that, like, you know, if he's just going to be known as the continuity candidate, then no one's going to get like interested or excited for, you know, his vision for like governing Scotland and like, you know, leading the SNP to independence. So like this kind of like first activist thing that he like came out with during the leadership contest is very interesting. And the SNQs are very interesting to watch, because like he was like, it was sort of seeing like what it was sort of a vision of what like first activist actually meant. And like, you know, I'm hardly like, you know, I'm not going to be super enthused about anyone in the SNP, you know, like epitome of colours to the mast there. Like, but like, you know, I'm glad that Hamza Yousaf is first minister. He's definitely someone that our party can work with. And I think there's definitely an opportunity there to like go above and beyond the letter of the Peace House Agreement.
So, how do you think his performance was and what he was saying at FMQs, not minding the climate activists that stopped the proceedings five times before he actually got on with it? How do you think he got on with what he was saying in response to, well, silly questions from Douglas Ross to begin with, but other questions after that? Was it good? Setting the right
I mean, the funny thing was like all the interruptions were when Douglas Ross got up to speak. I mean, naturally, any time that Douglas Ross gets up to speak is a natural lull in the conversation. I mean, like I feel like once you've heard one like question from Douglas Ross at FMQs, you've heard them all. I feel like I could just like recite it in my sleep at this point. It's like something about independence obsession, fairies. Season.
The thing that really gets me about Douglas Ross is his consistent accusations about divisiveness. When he and his party live on divisiveness, this is a party that's currently stoking up hatred of immigrants in order to distract from their own failures. That strikes me as much, much more divisive than wanting to discuss your country's constitutional future. And there's that thing about, I mean, it was Liam Byrne, he was a Labour politician who said that they were for the strivers, not for the scroungers, which to me sounds like the most divisive thing a politician could possibly say. And to have the politicians from those parties consistently saying, oh, we want to stop divisiveness, we want to stop division. They don't want to stop division. They know that their tactics are based on division. It's just this is a division they don't like. They don't like talking about the future of the country, about giving people a right to have a say about the future of their country. They'd much rather the division was on the basis of whether there are too many immigrants, which there absolutely aren't, and whether there are scroungers and other people that they can pick out as targets for abuse. And I know which kind of debate I would rather have. I'd rather have a straight up debate about the future of our country rather than a debate about whether or not we could find innovative ways to crack down on people who need social security or people who are immigrants. Those are pretty arid discussions, and they're really a distraction. And that's the thing that always gets me about Douglas Ross. He opened up with that thing about how Hamza was even more divisive than Nicola Sturgeon. And I mean, just today, the UK government at Westminster is back at stirring up hatred against Muslims, because that's the well they go back to when they're failing politically. And it's really it, that's really problematic. That's the divisiveness we need less of. And I think, we should always be up for a debate about the future of the country. That's not the debate they want to have. And I really find myself getting very annoyed with Douglas Ross every time he does that.
I think it's the only line he has, and like it's just like really trite, and like it's frustrating, because like it's only ever considered divisive when it's not in the interest of the bosses and the landlords, the kind of people who bankroll the Tory party, like somehow it's never divisive when they do it, because that's how they drum up their votes, right? Is like defense of the union or whatever, but like when it's like an actual alternative, or when it's like an actual vision of like of how things could be different, oh, then suddenly it's divisive. But like how can it be divisive if you need a majority, like a majority vote in a referendum to get it done? Like you need to build a coalition that you can take with you in that. By definition, it's how it works. But I suppose like they're coming at it from a viewpoint of having rammed through Brexit against Scotland's will. So, like that's their idea of a fair referendum. And they think like that's what's going to happen when it's like the shoe's on the other foot. So they're not going to want to have that conversation.
Definitely. That's what they're like through and through, isn't it? Right. Okay. Our next pick on the list is Margaret Ferrier, MP in Westminster, was originally SNP, but the whip has been withdrawn, and that's her being taken to task for, I don't know, what's the word? Transgressions against COVID rules in 2020.
I was going to say gross stupidity. I mean, I think, like, I never want punitive sanctions against people. I think that's really unhelpful. But the idea that somebody who's a decision maker, who's a representative, made such bad decisions, discovering that she had COVID and then deciding to get on a train and travel 400 miles, putting everyone in the way at risk, just seems to me that our position is completely untenable. And we used to have this situation, we've had the situation in Scotland where people have done things that show that their decision-making skills weren't very good, and they've kind of continued and limped on in office. She really needed to resign quite a long time ago. I hope she will resign. I mean, it seems if she doesn't resign, there's obviously going to be a by-election anyway, so she's not going to be there for much longer. And it just it's a I mean, it's a sad story, but I don't think you can continue to be a representative in that context. When you've done something like that,
I
and
mean, I'm not going to shed any tears for, the law was the law at the time. Those are the rules. Like it was a public health emergency. Everyone had to stay at home, right? And like as more of these as more of these as more of these revelations came out of like more and more of the elites not actually following the rules that they set out for the rest of us, like that undermined the public health response. I remember in the first lockdown, like everyone was on the same page. Like nobody wanted to do it. But we all, like, most people understood that, you know, it was like a, it was a public health emergency, that everyone had to, like, everyone had to stand together on that. And there was this sense that, like, everyone was in the same boat, you know, as hard as it was, as horrible as it was. But then, like, you know, when we went into the second lockdown, the third lockdown, you know, people realized that, oh, well, you know, like, government ministers aren't doing it. MPs aren't following the rules. Like, why should I?
Yeah, but it is that kind of overall arrogance, isn't it? Tuukka Tess suspected she had COVID, and from what I've looked at, went to church after that, which is nothing religious based. They are just going to a place where there's lots of other people in the same area, and then travels on the train down to London, goes into the House of Commons, where there's a lot of people in close proximity as well. You know, and then got the result that she was positive, and decides to travel back up in the train from Scotland afterwards. I mean, if that is not arrogance, goodness knows what is.
Well, it's not just arrogance, it's recklessness, and it's a disregard for public health and people's safety.
That's
You
true.
know, like, no sympathy for it whatsoever. I
I mean, I
mean,
think.
like, I'm surprised that he hasn't been given the boot earlier, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is really the first opportunity they had to give her the boot because they had to wait for the court case and whatever else. One of the things I was concerned about around the time of COVID was that the police were very, very enthusiastic about using their powers to stop people gathering. I mean, we all remember the Reclaim the Night protest after Sarah Everard was killed. Where the police, let's say, took the regulations with the greatest deal of enthusiasm that they could deploy, and you know those sort of dreadful scenes of women being carried away by police because they were trying to have a vigil for somebody who'd been killed with the. You know, with the trying to abide by the regulations, a really extraordinary thing. And I mean, almost everyone I know who got a fine during the COVID period was black or minority ethnic. And I haven't seen the statistics, but I have a very strong suspicion that what the police were doing was going to the usual people that they like to pick up. Picking them up and prosecuting them rather than looking at people who might be breaking the rules but look like the police. And I think I thought for that reason it's a good argument for some kind of amnesty for people who had convictions from the period during COVID. I mean, there's that sort of notorious moment where they were going around parks in London checking to see if people were sweating enough. Doing their exercise. So they were if you weren't sweating then it wasn't appropriate. You know, there's that sort of that move to authoritarianism that I thought was really problematic. And I kind of if we are going to have more public health emergencies, which it looks like we will do, I do want us not to have those as ways of either freeloading like what happened with all the contracts. Or creeping authoritarianism, like what happened with, I think, some of the policing of lockdown.
And it was definitely like that, the inequity in that response to it, like, you know, using a fine to punish people for that is like, you know, a fine is basically just like, for rich people, a fine is just like what you pay to be able to break the law, you know. So it's probably another reason why, like MPs and ministers and so on just felt they could flout those rules of impunity.
Well, it
Because,
turns
like,
out it.
if you're an essential worker, or, you know, like, or you're shielding or something like that, like, or, you know, you're looking after someone who's shielding, like, you just, like, chances are you're not in the position to be able to pony up that fine, you know?
It turns out it's no barrier to becoming prime minister either.
Unfortunately, very true. Unfortunately, very true.
But definitely, like, you know, the pandemic really, like, It really hit the country at the worst possible time, right? Like of all the administrations that have been in charge at the time, like I think that we ended up with the worst one, except maybe the Trump administration.
I mean, Bolsonaro was pretty bad
Oh,
in
they
Brazil.
just kind of ignored all of it and said it was a hoax, didn't they? Yeah. But
I and you know it was just like it was just used as an excuse to funnel hundreds of millions of public money to all their mates,
I mean that's the really grossly offensive thing about all of this was the they could rustle up billions of pounds for big consultancy firms and Michelle Moon and whoever else, and now they're telling us that they can't afford to give a decent pay deal to teachers. And I mean, like, I often wish people understood how much these sums of money were. I mean, that track and trace system was about the same as the Scottish budget for a year, like all of the Scottish government's budget. So all of health, all of education, everything else that the Scottish government does, and they blew that on a track and trace system that basically didn't work. You know, I
Yeah,
mean, it's an
I.
absolutely extraordinary sum of money, and they're closing libraries in Aberdeen because we don't have 260 grand.
I like it was very opportunistic. It was like another, it's disaster capitalism in action, right? Using like a public health emergency just to, asset strip the country basically. And they always find the money for these kind of things when they want to, anytime that's something that might help the working class gets proposed, it's always like, well, how are you going to pay for it? But they always find the money for what they want to pay for.
They
You know,
definitely
and
do.
it shows when they spaff away billions on dodgy PPE contracts or things like this,
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
We have skirted on and mentioned briefly before the immigration policies of the UK government and how bad they are. We have the small boats policy coming in, and they have been talking about using former military camps to put asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants, and I think part of the problem is we've got all these different names for the same people. But they're talking about that, putting them in military camps, which sounds good to some people. But the local councils that in the areas that they're proposing to do that are starting to put up objections. But part of it, I can't remember who it was that said it, but they said it in Parliament. They want to meet the essential living needs and nothing more. And that was to stop attracting millions or possibly billions of people wanting to come to Britain. So they'll go, oh, right, we'll go to Britain because we go to a military camp and we get a nice bed and we get a hot shower. And that's why people want to migrate. But anyway, what about the measures of the UK government proposing at the moment? Do you think there's any reality in there? Because they're talking about using barges as well and seeking out barges to put people on. Is that going to give people essential living needs? Or is it all just kind of smoke and mirrors to distract from everything else? What do you think?
I mean, like, the cruelty is the point, right? Like, you know, the stuff that's coming out about, like, you know, the flight to Rwanda that was stopped. You know, the reports that came out of that were just like absolutely terrifying. Like, it made my blood run cold, if I'm honest. You know, like people on the planes were like, they're self-harming, like, you know, they were threatening to like take their own life. Like, they were being like, you know, they were being put on like, they're being forcibly restrained, like, you know, begging not to be deported, you know. And then there was the report on Thursday, you know, basically like from the Home Office advising like the use of force on children.
Yeah, that was
Like, it's
absolutely appalling, that report that I saw in that. I mean, just imagine somebody, a small child, or even not a small child, just a child that's been taken, had to be separated from their parents, either because they've had to flee for their life, or their parents have been dead in the first place. And then the possibility of that kind of physical constraint and stuff that we're talking about. Oh, dear. That's.
I mean, like, you know, there's no way to, like, there's no way to ethically do that. You know, it's completely unconscionable. Like, not to mention against, you know, Britain's obligations under international law. And like, it is so cynical. It is just like, it is just like a distraction from their incompetence at best and their corruption at worst. You know, asset stripping the country.
And it's worth noting that all of this is happening at the moment. I mean the bar, do you remember when Chris Grayling, I'm sorry if I've just brought him back into your mind. Do you remember when Chris Grayling signed a contract with a ferry company that didn't have any ferries? I think there's a very strong element of, you know, the barges. No, you know, none of this is about an actual solution to a problem. It's not really a problem, so solving it would be counterproductive. What they're trying to do is keep the issue alive. Because having something that allows them to point at a crisis that they can be hard on, and that Labour find it difficult to be hard on, is something that's politically useful to them. And it's all happening in the context of the English local elections, which are in it should be in 4 weeks' time, but it's not because the coronation's at 6 weeks' time. All of this is because of the English local elections, because Rishi Sunak doesn't want to be the first Tory leader to lose 1,000 seats in on a single day. And it looked like they were going to do that. So they've decided to ramp up the rhetoric about small boats. And I don't know if you remember the 2018 US midterms, the right-wing media decided to create a refugee caravan that they were reporting from daily as it made its way through Mexico, so that they could avoid having to talk about all of the problems of the Trump regime. This feels like it's exactly the same thing. And of course, we know that immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers, as you know, as Neil says, we use these terms interchangeably, and maybe we shouldn't, but we're using them interchangeably because that's how the government uses them, because they're a political football and they're getting kicked very, very hard at the moment. In no small part because they can pretend that the reason why your public services have declined in quality is not because they've made a mess of them, but because somebody from somewhere else has come and taken them away from you. And that's obviously absurd, but people are convinced by it, and that's a big part of the attraction of this line for them. So, you know, there are other targets. We've seen trans people being a target. We've seen traveling communities being a target, but immigrants have this fantastic additional accusation that you can level at them, that they're stealing your NHS. Absolutely, of course they're not, but That's the argument that they're making, and that's why it's so important for them to keep this issue alive. That's why we've had the Rwanda scheme, which is patently absurd. Israel tried to do it, and I think they managed to deport seven people, and all of those people wandered off. They couldn't identify where they'd been. Getting your immigrant policy from Israel is problematic in the first place, but it's obvious that it's not serious. It's incredibly expensive, and I'm quite sure they chose Rwanda because in people's minds that's associated with a genocide, and therefore it sounds like a great place to send these nasty people who've come to our country for reasons we just can't understand. I think the dripping cynicism is almost unforgivable.
I mean, these are refugees. Like, they're fleeing like wars. They're fleeing, like persecution. They're fleeing natural disasters. And there's a, going back to the issue of, using vulnerable people's lives as political footballs. There's a very marked difference in, the way that Ukrainian refugees are talked about, and the way that refugees who aren't white are talked about. It's very transparent, and it is despicable.
It definitely is. I mean, if somebody wanting to immigrate to United Kingdom for whatever reason, good or bad, and they look like like we do, we're all kind of white Caucasian people, and that, yeah, that's people accept that easily. But if somebody looks different from that stereotype, there a lot of people seem to have a problem.
I mean, the right wing narrative tars these people as quote migrants because they want to. They want to push the narrative that these people are just choosing to come to the country on a jolly. That's the narrative that they're trying to push. As if it's they're choosing to come here, But again, they are refugees, they are fleeing, they're seeking safe harbor.
Yeah. I'm sure it's been it's reported that, the vast majority of people that want to come to the UK are coming here because they've got family or because they speak English, and that's probably because they're in a former empire colony, and that's where they learned their English, or they know something about our culture already, again, from being that kind of former colony, and Afghanistan, for instance, included in there. The British were in charge of it for a short while, etc. So they're not just coming. I mean, the perception from the right wing is that they're coming here because they think it's a cushy number. They're going to get fantastic accommodation, free money every week, etc. But that's not why MD is coming here, and it's not what they get. But it's because they feel a link to the UK, and they feel that they'll be treated well when they come here, and that's so disappointing when people do get here and they're coming to the UK because they think they're going to be treated well and treated fairly, and then they're treated like scum by our presiding government at the moment.
It's the week of April Fool's Day, and I'm still not sure if it was an April Fool or not, but there was a report that Theresa May, when she was the Home Secretary, ahead of the opening of the borders to Romanian and Bulgarian EU citizens back when we were in the EU, she paid for an advertising campaign in Romania and Bulgaria telling people about how terrible Britain was. And I think it can be said that she definitely did achieve making Britain more terrible as a result of her long stint as Home Secretary and lastly Prime Minister. But I think there's another thing here, which is that refugees are coming from Syria, They're coming from Yemen. They're coming from Afghanistan. They're coming from Iraq. These are countries that we have decided. And I mean, our actions in Yemen at the moment are unconscionable and despicable, where we're arming both sides in a conflict that's generating tens of thousands of refugees. And they're saying, oh, what have we got to do with it? Well, the weapons were made in the UK and sold by the UK government in order to accelerate that war and that crisis. We're responsible for what's happened in Syria because we destabilized Iraq so that Tony Blair could feel messianic. We made such a mess out of Afghanistan that the Taliban were able to take the country over in 6 weeks once American troops withdrew. These refugees are a direct result of British foreign policy, of both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, and the notion that there's nothing we could do about this or it's nothing to do with us is not just silly, it's immoral. It's deeply immoral to say we're going to profit from the bombs we drop on your houses and then we're going to say we don't know why you've come to our country. You have to decide to be on one side of that or the other. And I mean, I very much support Ukrainian refugees who are in this country, but I do find it extraordinary how differently they're treated to Yemeni refugees in this country. And we all know what the reasons behind that are, but it does strike me that our culpability in Yemen is much greater than any culpability we had in Ukraine. And the responsibility that we therefore have to those refugees should be greater. And we need to take this a lot more seriously than we do. Stop it being treated as a political football. The critique of the UK government should never be, the problem is that their cruelty isn't efficient enough. The critique of the government should be that they are immoral, that they should stop arming combatants in Yemen, and that we should pick up the tab for our actions in Iraq, in Afghanistan, the spillover actions in Syria, and all of the other things that we've been responsible for.
Yep. Totally. 100%. Totally, I mean, agree with you there.
Nail on the head there. Not much more to add.
Yeah, so will we move on to our final topic then? So the UK government hasn't approved as yet, but it's not approved, if that's the right way around, possibly giving go ahead for drilling for oil and gas in the Rosebank oil field. And in that, it could produce 500 million barrels of oil, 69,000 a day, and 44 million cubic meters of gas per day. Whilst the UK government is also touting all their wonderful policies about reaching net zero on carbon dioxide emissions by whatever year it is, 2050 or something in there. And to me, that neither the two of them are totally anachronistic. Why would you sanction taking more oil and gas out of the ground while saying, we're going to have carbon capture, etc.? Do you think any of the mitigations that they're talking about will actually do anything?
Well, no, absolutely not. Rosebank, when it's operational, will generate more carbon emissions than 28 countries in the global south combined. That one oil field in a year would generate the emissions of 700 million people.
Wow.
Yeah. And that one oil field alone would blow Britain's entire carbon budget. There's no way that with the speculative technology that carbon capture is, Like, it hasn't been implemented at scale, like nowhere near the scale to offset the entire thing. And even then, carbon capture is just another one of these, like, these techno fixes for emissions, for like, basically just a way for the oil and gas companies to like kick the can down the road. So of course the Tories are gonna champion it. Like, the thing is, it's like net zero is just like that is not the goal in itself. Like, net zero is just the start of like further decarbonization of the economy. And like relying on carbon capture, or like planting trees, or things like that, for carbon offsetting, it's sort of like trying to empty a bath by like using a teaspoon, it's just completely ineffective. And it ignores the reality of like of how fossil fuel works, right? Like, any amount of carbon emission is going to damage the environment. It is going to heat the atmosphere. So like the
And
idea that you can like offset it, is just kind of absurd. It's like if someone needs to quit smoking, right? And they say like, oh, I'm gonna quit by 2050. And like, they're using like, it's like they're, doing a run every morning. And it's like you do a run every morning, that offsets the 20 a day. Like, I'm sure, running is obviously good, right? But like these things do not offset each other, And so like things like using like these techno fixes that the oil and gas companies love to, to hide behind, to like be able to keep on doing what they're doing, siphoning profits from local communities into their own pockets.
And just on Rosebank itself, in particular, seeing things that says that the actual efficiency of getting oil and gas from there actually makes the carbon problem even worse. Because if you just had it, say, on your doorstep, it would be X amount, but I'm sure it's still something that is at least double by the time you extract it from there and bring it onshore, and use it. And in that particular as well, it's a Norwegian company that are going to do it. It's not a UK company, and they have no obligation to sell any of that to the UK. So any argument about, we don't have to buy gas from Russia, it's going to make us more sustainable in that way, is not in the argument either, because that Equinor, I think, if that's how you say it,
Hi, Equinor is what it's called. So the Norwegian government are a majority stakeholder in
so they
Equinor. And then I
but
think that the other two stakeholders are a Canadian company called Suncor, I think. And then like I think the remaining 20% stake is in Ithaca, which is like an Israeli company. So so it's like majority owned by the Norwegian government, but there still are like private stakeholders in other countries. It's funny how like the conservatives love they love public ownership as long as it's any other country doing it. And like the profit, like not the profits that that Rosebank are going to make, like Scotland isn't going to see that money. Shetland isn't going to see that money. Britain isn't going to see that money. It's going to be siphoned off to Norway's sovereign wealth fund, which is already in the trillions. They do not need that money.
I think there are two interesting other points on this. So the first one is, a number of times I've been asked to write things about climate adaptation. So climate adaptation is what you do to deal with a warming climate. And every time I've tried to write that, I thought, could we not just avoid this? Because this is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds achieving nothing other than protecting things that need to be protected because we insisted on pumping out fossil fuels, fossil fuel carbon emissions at this point in time. And every time I go back to that, I think this is the reason why we have to do the quickest transition we possibly can. We find, you know, we can find billions of pounds to fight wars. If we spent the, you know, if we spent the money that we spent on the Iraq war on a just transition away from oil and gas, we'd be in a position now where we wouldn't have to be thinking about those things. But instead, we went to Iraq to get cheap oil and have made a gigantic mess. And we did that instead of the clean energy transition that we should have done at that point. And there's all of this stuff. I mean, I noticed the Tory politician in charge of this saying, well, unless you have an alternative to oil and gas, you have to keep drilling. And of course, we've been arguing for 30 years that we needed an alternative, and they've been saying we'll do it later. But just for now, we're going to go for a dash for gas. I mean, there was a policy decision made by George Osborne in 2013 to shift the UK towards maximum extraction of gas and dependence on gas. That's why we got hit hardest by the gas price spike over the last year. These policies have been completely counterproductive, and we've landed ourselves in a position where we're about to drill more. I mean, we know it's not going to come to the UK. We know it's not going to reduce the price of energy in the UK, which, of course, if we were to install our own renewable infrastructure, would reduce the cost of energy in the UK. We know that that would have the direct impact. And the idea that we need to do more drilling for oil and gas is obviously absurd. And the second thing I wanted to say is I really worry about carbon capture and storage, because I think that's going to be used in the way that offsetting was used at the very beginning of offsetting, where you offset 5% of your emissions and then 20 companies all claim that it was their 5% that was offset. You've offset 5% of what you were offset of what was emitted, but because 20 people are claiming it, you've sold it 20 times and you've got 20 times the profit from selling it, and you've only abated 5% of your emissions, and you're claiming that you've abated 100%, or maybe even more than 100%. And that's where we're going to end up with this. Scotland has one gas-powered power station, so there's only one place we could do carbon capture and storage, and that's at Peterhead. We do that. It's uneconomic because gas is already the most expensive form of energy, and you're adding a process where you capture the carbon and another process where you have to sequester the carbon, put it underground. Those are two additional costs to an already expensive form of energy. It might have worked when gas was the cheapest form of energy 20 years ago. It's not going to work now. So the question is, why are we still pursuing this? And I think there are two reasons. One is so that you can do cheap neutral. You can sell the permits over and over again. And the second thing, and this is even more worrying, is that the economic case for sequestration, for putting the carbon underground, is that it helps you to push out more oil and gas. So you pump the carbon in at one end and you pump the oil and gas out at the other. So you're actually, even if you were certifying this properly, you're almost certainly going to increase extraction of oil and gas and do more of that frying of the planet. And then you're back to where I started and saying, why did we have to spend? And there's a report suggesting it cost £400 million to defend just Glasgow. That's not to do anything productive. That's just to stop Glasgow going underwater. £400 million.
Wow.
Now, you think about those costs for every coastal city, and you look at just how gigantic this is, and you look at why we're still pumping this stuff, which is to create some profits for oil and gas companies. And you go back and you ask yourself, is it worth it? And it absolutely, definitely is not worth it. And we absolutely have to do the quickest transition out of oil and gas that we possibly can. And that should mean getting every bit of finance we can behind renewables and getting our grid well over 100%, so that we have to rely as little as possible on storage or on other forms of energy, because the costs are going to be gigantic, and that's just for us.
And like, you know, not just like transitioning away from obviously from fossil fuel, but also like, you know, who is leading that, like, that change, right? Like, really, like, you know, the people who are working in these industries, like, need to be re-equipped with the skills to, like, you know, the retraining to be able to, like, pivot into these industries. You know, like, currently the situation is with, like, oil and gas workers who are wanting to go into renewable, like, the renewable sector, like, they're having to pay for their own costs of training. Which is, like, obviously counterproductive. And, like, you know, I think it's pretty clear from, like, this, like this so-called net zero strategy that the Conservative government put out. You know, it's pretty clear who they're listening to. Like, they're not listening to the workers in these industries.
Nope.
Like, who are asking for, like, publicly owned energy, locally owned energy, like, you know, paid, like, training to, like, move into the renewable sector. They're not listening to these workers. They're only listening to the people who own these oil and gas companies.
Yeah, well, certainly.
Because who pays them?
Yeah. Current government really only listens to profit, doesn't it? Profit, profit, profit.
Bye.
Right. Well,
then what else is new?
True. Well, I think that brings us to a conclusion on what we've been doing. Thank you both very much for joining in. Your contributions have been absolutely fantastic. So thank you to Jen and to Peter. And that is us. You can find all our podcasts at leftungagged.org, as well as written articles, and you can sign up for our free newsletter. Catch the Talking Sense podcast with Kat and Erin. If you have anything you want to talk to us about, tweet us at _ungagged, #HolyroodUngagged, or email us at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Holyrood Ungagged in the subject line. If you enjoyed this, please give us 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you use. You can also join our Discord community. Have fun, be good, and be lucky. And good night to everyone. Cheers.
Thank you.